From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Gay Wilson Allen of New York University is the author of a new biography of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the first such major work in more than 30 years. Professor Allen recently visited the National Humanities Center, where I talked with him about Ralph Waldo Emerson, who lived from 1803 through 1882.
Emerson in the 19th century was not only a major, but perhaps almost the major American writer. But in the early 20th century, his reputation began to decline. And as Melville was discovered, and Whitman's reputation began to build, and then a little bit later, Emily Dickinson, they more or less took the place. They were the major 19th century writers, and Emerson and Longfellow and Whittier began to recede into the background.
Well, what is it that makes Emerson important?
His ideas are much more pertinent to us today than we had thought they were. And it's partly, I think, because the language had deceived 20th century readers, particularly those of the last generation. Certain words are unfamiliar, the soul and the oversoul and so on, whereas Whitman's language and Emily Dickinson's language somehow seems to be more contemporary, almost more our own than Emerson.
How would you describe the impact of Emerson's thinking on life in the United States in the 19th century?
That isn't perhaps easy to answer. Many people would say that he was the dominant thinker. In fact, at his death, he was called the American philosopher, perhaps the only American philosopher. Yet, on the other hand, there are plenty of people who would say he was not a philosopher at all, and that perhaps really is true. He certainly was a great influence on what has been called the American Renaissance. That movement about 1850 and 60s, of course, his essays came earlier than that. And he was certainly a great influence there. He was an influence also on Whitman, and it would seem he was an influence on Emily Dickinson, although that may be just paralleled, but there are great similarities there. Now, Melville disliked the Transcendentalists and made fun of them.
Why was that?
Well, partly because, well, it says if a man has a toothache, don't just tell him to think about the all. Don't tell him it's just in his mind. He thinks it's very real. But actually, Melville had much more in common with him than he realized, and there are parts of Melville's writings that you could say, as a matter of fact, could be called as transcendental as some of Emerson's writings.
Does this mean that Emerson was out of touch with the affairs of the world, with the way the world works?
Well, that was a common conception, I think, and it may have been true in the earlier years. In fact, Carlyle complained about his essays that he lived too much in the stratosphere and he wanted to come down to Earth. But as time went on, he came more and more down. And in the biography, I try to trace that. In the Divinity School address, for example, and certain other lectures which he gave a little bit after that, which were also influenced very strongly by Neoplatonism, especially by Plotinus, he went about as far, as one of my friends says, as far north as he ever went. Then he began to come down toward the earth and toward reality, and there was a progression toward facing the real experience, the American experience, until finally you get to one of his later books called Conduct of Life. It's not so abstract and it's not difficult. It's one of his most popular books because of that. Some people say a superficial book.
Could you call Emerson a practical man and be fair to him and his circumstances?
Well, it depends on what way you call him practical. In his own affairs, he was not practical. He was in debt until after his daughter married a rich man and the son-in-law became his business manager. And after that, Emerson lived fairly well. But before, every year he would borrow from the Concord Bank and pay back some of the money and renew the note, and he was always in debt.
Was he viewed with skepticism or suspicion by the people among whom he moved?
A great many. There were people in New England who absolutely adored him. In fact, some even thought he was a kind of a saint, and they called him a sage and so on. In the just before the Civil War, William Dean Howells, as a matter of fact, he had just written a campaign biography for Abraham Lincoln. He visited Emerson, and in the account which he wrote a little bit later, he said that Emerson was a national joke. And that really surprised me very much. I didn't think that he was that much disapproved of.
Well, what would have motivated a comment like that?
Just as you said, he was an idealist, and his feet were not on the ground, and so on. I think, though, if one reads his lectures, and even some of the essays, one of the most marvelous essays is called Experience. The trouble is that the people know other essays, like The Oversoul, which lead them to say he's a mystic, and they emphasize his mysticism. Well, you can find mysticism in Emerson all right, and maybe a few epiphanies, although I don't think he had very many. I don't think he was a mystic very much in that sense. He was more a mystic in a philosophical sense. But he came more and more to understand the American experience, and he traveled widely. After all, he lectured every year. He traveled as far as the Mississippi. He walked across the Mississippi on the ice more than once, because there was no other way for him to get across, apparently. He rode trains sometimes for days. He stayed in dinky hotels, and in one hotel, Niagara Falls, they had a fire, and he just barely escaped with himself and his manuscript. All kind of adventures of that sort.
Well, the fact that he would go out and give lectures indicates that, one, he was making a living, but it also indicates that he was staying in touch with people, that he had a desire to spread his ideas and to talk to the public.
I think that's quite true. One can also trace the effect in the style of his lectures. He had to adapt himself to his listeners more and more, and he was conscious of that. One time in his journal, he complained that he was not able to make the people laugh as some other popular lectures were, and he would have to insert that into his lecture. He'd have to come down to it. Actually, I don't think he made much of an effort of that kind, but he did attempt to get more in touch with his audience.
Professor Allen, is it true that Emerson was something of an iconoclast?
Well, he was indeed an iconoclast, yes. I think I will skip nature because that's quite complicated, but let me say that American Scholar address in 37 and his Divinity School address in 38 did really shock a great many people. In fact, it shocked the proper people at Harvard so much he was not invited back for a generation.
Well, what did he say? Why did he upset
them? Well, in the Divinity School address, what he said was he was speaking to the Divinity School students and their teachers. He is saying that the ministers of your church, the Unitarian Church, are so conventional, so unimaginative, so dull, that the church is dying. And he wanted them to face the kind of experience that they were having. Of course, the big question was, they speak about God as if he existed back in the Old Testament time. He said, God is, not was. He wanted religion to be an experience now, whereas those people, and they were fashionable, gentlemanly type of people, they went to church on Sunday to hear something soothing, to do the proper thing, to wear the right kind of clothes and be seen. It was all just a matter of gesture and convention.
Well, things haven't changed very much, have they?
Well, maybe they haven't.
What does Emerson say to Americans in the 20th century in 1982?
Well, I don't like to use any writer as a text, as scripture. I think that's been one of the troubles with some of the works on other writers like Melville as scriptures. Scripture. I remember Kazan has condemned that very hardly, and I agree with him. But it seems to me that if there is any American writer who probably came close to the American experience, it was Emerson, even more than Whitman, who has been my specialty. Whitman did know America in many ways, But I don't think he had as wide, extensive a knowledge as Emerson did. And John Dewey says that if the a philosophy of democracy is ever achieved, published, it would turn out that Emerson is that philosopher. And Santayana and William James also made similar statements about his importance as a central thinker in the American experience. I regard him as central in the whole stream development of the American experience. I somewhat resent the fact that he is so often quoted, I think somewhat bastardized his self-reliance doctrine, the merchants, the self-made man, who know nothing of Emerson except a few quotations. The man who makes a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to his doorway, that sort of thing. It's inspirational, you see. Well, he can be very inspirational, but I don't think that is going very deep into the Emerson experience. And you have to read more than one of his works to understand that.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with Gay Wilson Allen of New York University. Professor Allen is the author of a new biography of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the first such major work in more than 30 years. Allen is also the author of biographies of Walt Whitman and William James. Joining in this part of the conversation with Professor Allen is Lewis Leary, Professor Emeritus of English at Columbia University and the University of North Carolina.
Professor Allen, could you just briefly sketch the shape of Emerson's life and career?
Well, the boy, as I've indicated, was rather unpromising. He didn't excel in school. He had three brothers who did excel in school. His parents thought he was not as bright as they were. He had to overcome that handicap. He made a mediocre record at Harvard. He couldn't get a job teaching in the Latin school in Boston because of his record. His brother was running a private school and employed him to teach girls, and he was very unhappy with that. He had been told somehow all of his life that he should go into the ministry, follow his father and his grandfather, and he just accepted that. Finally, it came the time when he should begin to be making preparations, and he went through a tremendous turmoil, even periods of doubt, and self-doubt particularly, and he became ill, probably tuberculosis, although some people think that was psychosomatic. At any rate, he was quite ill, and he had to make a trip south, came back much improved. Finally, after he began preaching, he met a girl who had tuberculosis, Ellen Tucker, whom he married. And at that time, he was still more or less conventional in his religion. For example, he and Ellen would talk about the future life and going to heaven, how they would recognize each other, and so on. But as soon as she died, well, I think I might take just a moment to comment on that. She had promised, they knew she was going to die, she had promised that she would never forget him in heaven, and she would communicate with him. In fact, he thought she would even sort of guide him, be a kind of spirit to guide him through the perils of life. And he was not able to get in touch with her. He prayed to her, no response. In his journals, he records that and indicates the despair that it brings. He did dream about her one night, but that was all. And I think that inability to communicate with her really changed his whole life. And it turned him not away from religion, but away from the religion he had been accepting and from his church, from which he finally resigned. And he was very ill as a result of the personal turmoil. One rather amusing aspect of that was he began to suffer from terrific diarrhea. He first thought he would take a trip to Puerto Rico, where his two brothers had gone when they were ill with tuberculosis. And then, just on impulse, there was a ship in port which was going to sail to Italy. And just on impulse, he signed up with it. It was carrying goods, cotton, carried only a few passengers. I forget the moment. I think there were five in all. But it was small. He set sail on a Christmas day with a storm just about to hit. They were trying to get out of port before the storm hit. As soon as he got out of port, the storm did hit. And for 5 days, nobody could eat anything. They couldn't cook anything. Of course, he fasted. The water got in his cabin and sloshed around in the bottom, and of course, you can imagine the filth. In fact, he even refers to that. Finally, the winds died down, and they could cook, and he discovered he had an appetite he could eat. And after that, he said he ate like a truckerman the rest of the trip, and he became a different man. Well, now, that kind of experience, I could give other examples, of course, enabled him to overcome these earlier handicaps.
Professor Allen, what about the shape of Emerson's later life?
Well, I had a problem with the last 10 years of his life, approximately the last 10 years, say from about 1871 to 1882 when he died. His house burned. His health was undermined. He was losing his memory. In fact, by the end, he had very little memory left. And you say, what did the man have to live for? My predecessor, Ralph Rusk, in his biography, has a great many pages on the, I can't remember the name of the chapter at the moment, at any rate, the dark shadow of Emerson's later life. Now, I felt that he made a mistake in drawing that out, giving too many details. It gave a depressing effect, which I felt didn't really fit Emerson. It wasn't that I wanted to make a happy ending, but it didn't seem to me that really was quite the truth of Emerson. Because Emerson, by his own character and his personality and by his effort, overcame those difficulties.
You have mentioned, Professor Allen, Emerson's influences on other writers. What about the immediate circle of writers that he knew and influenced? How would you characterize that?
Well, of course, the influence on Whitman is the most famous, I suppose. But the recent poets, and offhand, I'm afraid I won't be able to name them off so much, but I'd say in the 1970s and into the 80s, there are a number of younger poets who are coming around to Emerson, and his influence is felt more today, I think, than it has been perhaps in the past.
How is that?
Well, in the imagery, to a certain extent, taking up some of the themes which he wrote about, and you might perhaps say the attitudes toward democracy which he had. He was, of course, a great Democrat, though I might make one point right here. Professor Leary, in his book on Emerson, stresses that Emerson always insisted upon quality. He did not believe in the mass, but the individual. And he resented the fact that so many politicians seemed to depend entirely upon numbers. But he wanted quality to be uppermost in everything, insisted upon it.
Hasn't Emerson had a good deal of influence on Robert Frost and Edward Arlington Robinson, even?
Certainly on those. Robert Frost acknowledged that. I think it's a speech that Robert Frost made in which he said that Emerson was one of the great influences on him. It's quite true.
Professor Allen, could you comment briefly on the perils and rewards of the writing of biography?
Well, there are many perils, of course. One is to identify oneself too closely with the subject. I think it's a mistake for anyone. Well, I won't say anyone. Most of the time, a biography written to debunk a character, I think, it turns out not to be a very good work. But there may be exceptions. Carlos Baker, in his biography of Hemingway, shows what a very nasty man, in reality, Hemingway was. And I think that Baker was exactly right. that does not necessarily downgrade Emerson as a, Hemingway as a writer, but as a man, it's good to know what he really was. Now, the rewards are, I suppose it's a kind of a vicarious living in the life and the mind of a great man, a man much greater than one is, or the writer is himself, but it's a way he can share in that which he couldn't share just in his own private life. When my friend Malcolm Cowley suggested I write a biography of Emerson, which would be logical after Whitman and William James, at first I thought, oh, that prig, I don't much think I could spend all the time necessary. And then I began to explore a little bit, and I found out that I didn't really know the man. I taught Emerson for a great many years. I didn't really know the man. I became interested in his problems. He had a great many problems of illness and handicaps to overcome, and he overcame them. And that made him to me a very attractive person.
You say that you came to know the man. Let me ask you about the dangers of too closely identifying a writer's life with his work. That's a knot, I suppose, that biographers have to untangle.
Well, one does have to guard against that. I think in this case, where you have journals kept over a number of years, and you have letters, you can pretty well determine what is truth and what is fiction, what is self-deception. Now, if one went entirely by the published works, I think it could go wrong. But if you have these other personal writings written not to be published, I don't think Emerson really expected his journals to be published.
Mm-hmm. Professor Lurie?
Is there any danger, Gay, of making the man seem more important than his writings? The man seem more, the Hemingway seem more interesting than Hemingway's stories, Emerson, the man?
I think that is true. As a matter of fact, I've known a few writers, not as many as I would like to have, but I've known some very good writers whose private lives were really detestable. And it's a mistake. I think the mistake was made in some of the biographies of Poe.
Well, what right do we have to delve around in the dead bones of another man's life to reveal him as either as a saint or a stinker?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, some people, like Henry James, didn't want a biography at all. They thought that their private life should be kept private. Really felt very he felt very strongly about having somebody reveal his private life. The excuse to me is, the more, at least in my own experience, my own studies, the more I've learned about the writer, the better I felt I understood his writing. I also feel that in studying Emerson's difficulties, I came to feel much more sympathy with his ideas, see how he got the ideas. And in a sense, it enabled me to test whether they seemed to be practical and workable or not.
You've been listening to a conversation with Gay Wilson Allen of New York University. Mr. Allen is the author of a new biography of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Also participating in the conversation was Lewis Leary, Professor Emeritus of English at Columbia University and the University of North Carolina. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The problem of energy is on just about everyone's mind these days. John Opie, a scholar at the National Humanities Center who teaches environmental history at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, comments now on the cultural and qualitative dimension of the energy issue.
It seems that Americans don't have a sense of what our basic conceptions in our society can be without an intensive use of energy as we've been used to it in the future. And not only our basic conceptions of what the benefits of American society are, but virtually all the alternatives that we can think up come into question as well, unless one is a romantic who really believes that we can return to the countryside. And I think increasingly fewer and fewer people are making that kind of an argument, but rather developing a much more balanced point of view. There's been talk of alternative technologies, or I guess the buzzword these days is appropriate technologies. But I think behind this are the questions of what Americans want out of the future. And of course, we have no way of predicting the future, but our tradition in American society has been to define our identities, our opportunities, the notions of liberty, democracy, equality, in terms of growth. And of course, the word GNP constantly surfaces before us. And when we talk about growth, I think we're really talking about two other things. One of them is the notion of abundance in American society. Back in the 50s, the historian David Potter, in fact, spoke of Americans as being people of plenty and seeing themselves as this way. And in fact, if there was anything we were carrying as a message to the rest of the world, it was this notion of abundance. And today we have to think of this in terms of cheap food and cheap energy. And of course, these are two aspects of our lives that have been transformed in the last few years. We can even date it, I suspect, going back to 1973. The other aspect of growth, I believe, could be described in terms of redundancy. When Americans think of an American way of life or a standard of living, then I think we think, for example, of a variety of energy resources. If we begin to dislike nuclear power, for whatever reasons, right or wrong, we think we can automatically switch over to gas or to natural gas or to oil or to coal. Or when we buy a car, we have choices. We can attend churches of our choice. We can experience a variety of jobs, even our choice of such ordinary things as a variety of TV shows. It's something we take for granted. All these are redundancies. So if one part of our lives demands some kind of a change, then we can simply switch gears and flip the switches in another way. I think we're being surprised. And traditionally, again, our notion of quality of life has been tied to abundance, redundancy, unlimited resources of not only energy, but also food. We have to remember that the energy crisis doesn't stand by itself, but rather is part of an ongoing set of transitions that are taking place in America today. And even with the political candidates as they appear on the scene, they are making this point repeatedly, that there are vast changes which Americans seem to be going through. And perhaps part of the reason that the energy crisis seems so awesome is that these enormous changes seem to be upon us, and there are people who seem to be saying, these have never happened before.
John Opie is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of environmental history at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. Professor Opie is founding editor of the interdisciplinary journal Environmental Review. He is also the founder and first president of the American Society for Environmental History. Opie is the author of many articles and reviews on environmental issues and the history of technology in American culture. At the National Humanities Center, Professor Opie is a member of a seminar entitled Energy and the Values of Modern Society. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, with an invitation for you to join me for Soundings. My guests this week are Gay Wilson Allen of New York University, who will discuss his new biography of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the first such major work in more than 30 years. And John Opie, an environmental historian from Duquesne University, who comments incisively on the qualitative dimension of America's energy problems. I hope you'll be listening for Soundings.